Good morning to all our listeners. Good afternoon and good evening to those of you who are outside the Washington, D.C. area. I'm Suzanne Maloney. I'm Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. And on behalf of all of my colleagues at Brookings and the Foreign Policy Program, I'm really delighted to welcome you to this Twitter Spaces event celebrating the launch of my colleague Dan Byman's newest book, Spreading Hate, The Global Rise of White Supremacist Terrorism. This is an incredibly important and timely book. Those of you who've read any of Dan's numerous books and other publications know that he's one of the foremost scholars of terrorism, counterterrorism, and Middle East security. In this book, he focuses his lens on white supremacists and offers an illuminating look at their evolution tactics and activities around the world, as well as recommendations on how to counter the threat. Dan looks at the broader ramifications of white supremacy in the United States. He uncovers gaps in our current policies. He also emphasizes the enormous impact that white power terrorists have had in eroding the pillars of Western democratic institutions by exploiting social media and other technologies. Importantly, Dan also offers really sound advice on how the threat can be reduced by taking steps in coordination with law enforcement, intelligence communities, and technology companies, among others. Given the scope and the importance of this book, I'm confident that we're going to have a terrific conversation today. And appropriate to the importance of this issue, we've brought together two truly distinguished and impressive scholars to join Dan, who is himself truly distinguished and impressive, and discuss this book today. All of our panel brings deep insight into the threat of white supremacist terrorism in America and around the world today. Let me introduce them very briefly and then turn the floor over to our panel. Dr. Roshan Ray is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and professor of sociology, as well as executive director of the Lab for Applied Social Science Research at the University of Maryland at College Park. His work on racial equity, policing, and criminal justice reform has made him widely acclaimed, described by the Washington Post as a media and policy star. We're also joined by Heidi Byrick, Chief Strategy Officer and co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Terrorism. She formerly led the Southern Poverty Law Center's acclaimed intelligence project, which publishes the Intelligence Report and the Hate Watch blog. She is a deep expert on various forms of extremism, including the white supremacist, nativist, and neo-Confederate movements, as well as racism in academia. And last but not least, we are joined by the author himself, Dan Byman. He's a senior fellow in Brookings Center for Middle East Policy and a professor at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service in the Security Studies program. Dan previously served as a staff member on the 9/11 Commission, and he's the author of several notable books on conflict and terrorism in the Middle East. Dan, congratulations on this really important book, and we look forward to hearing from all of you during this discussion. In the interests of fostering an open discussion and engaging with our audience, we encourage you to offer questions at any point during our conversation today through the Brookings Twitter feed. Let me add a special note of thanks to several people who've made our discussion possible today. Raman Preet Kaur, who is Brookings' maestro of social media, especially Twitter Spaces, and Emily Kimball in the Foreign Policy Program. And now over to our panel. Dan, I'd like to turn to you first. You're one of the country's foremost experts on transnational terrorism. What prompted you to turn your focus toward the threat posed by white supremacists? And how do you assess that threat in the context of the wider terrorism threat, especially around the jihadist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS that you've analyzed for so long?
Thank you, Suzanne, and thank you to everyone here who's joining us on Twitter. So I began to look at this threat seriously in 2011 after a man named Anders Breivik did a devastating terrorist attack in Norway. And when the attack first occurred, my immediate instinct was that this is an Al-Qaeda or other jihadist attack. And it quickly became clear that this was a white supremacist. And Breivik had a model that was unfortunately emulated by others, this idea of being a mass shooter, of putting up a manifesto that where you try to spread it around the world, and also someone who really wasn't part of a formal organization, but was heavily networked and heavily engaged in the broader set of ideas. And as I began to follow it, of course, we began to see more and more attacks around the world, where we saw devastating attacks in New Zealand, other attacks in Europe, and of course, a series of attacks in the United States on worshipers at a historically Black church, at an El Paso Walmart, at a Pittsburgh synagogue. And all this was happening at the time when we saw much more divisive racial rhetoric from President Trump and many in his administration. And so what we care so much about with terrorism is not just the number of people who die, as tragic and horrible as that is, but the broader political impact. And this was really in stark contrast to a lot of the work I'd done in the past on the jihadist movement. There you had very organized groups. You had the ability of these groups to have often a sanctuary in places like Afghanistan and Syria. You had the groups having ability to train people and get them to a high degree of competence. And it was, if you will, from an American point of view, very much a threat emanating from foreign shores, with individuals at times showing up in the United States or coming from the United States abroad. And that was in sharp contrast to the white supremacist danger, where this is something deeply rooted in American history. You do have transnational connections that I'm happy to talk about, but the real key was this large group of people in the United States who have some degree of support for part of this agenda. And so you don't have a sanctuary in the same way. You don't have the highly skilled individuals in most cases, but you have a broader political impact because of this deep connection with American history and the engagement with broader American political issues. So what was at times painful, but also fascinating for me, were to see these differences and how they manifested.
Thanks so much, Dan. Rashad, I'd like to bring you into the conversation now. As Dan has noted, this is an issue that is deeply rooted in American history and American culture and American politics. You've described the effort to combat white supremacy as a battle for the soul of America. And I wondered if you could give us some perspective on how we come to this battle today, how it impacts our governing system and Americans, as well as the kind of wider context and historical context for this battle.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be on this conversation. Dan's book is so important. Everyone should go out and get it and read it. And in doing so, one of the things that I think Dan does a really good job of highlighting that speaks to your question is how I think about trickle-down white supremacy, the way that white supremacy becomes normalized. I won't necessarily hurt them unless they do something directly to me, but I don't want them in my neighborhood. And I would definitely laugh at a joke. And in this regard, it really highlights this typology that Dan lays out in juxtaposing extremists compared to militants and terrorists. In terms of thinking about extremists, of course, the individuals oftentimes with their ideas, promoting an ideology of white superiority. And then you have militants who oftentimes, of course, act up with violence, and then terrorists who aim to do it on a much broader scale. And so Dan really nailed it because he highlighted the way that social media platforms and companies don't necessarily always want to ban white supremacists because they're worried about losing revenue and political support. Consequently, it leads to more acceptance and a higher threshold of hate tolerance to make us all immune to how pervasive it is. And I think that is what's so important. If we look historically, particularly in the United States, but Dan's book does such a good job of expanding us beyond that, saying, look, this is happening in a lot of other parts of around the world. This has been happening for a while. And I think what it speaks to is particularly in the U.S. context, but even in Europe, right, following World War II, trying to deal with what happened with the Holocaust. And then, of course, in the U.S. context, aiming to grapple with enslavement and Jim Crow and segregation. People assume that progress was going to be linear. And part of what we know is that that's not exactly the case, that we actually continuously have to work at it. And I think that is one of the things that Dan's book does so good to highlight, is a lack of government direction. And accordingly has allowed for white supremacists, because of all the reasons Dan lays out in the book, of course, just wanting to uphold and be the rulers of the world, but also other factors that play a role, like Arlie Hochschild would talk about, in the way that many white people perceive to be strangers in their own land when it comes to opportunities and who are getting those. And it leads to this trickle-down normalization of white supremacy that continues to be a stain on not only America, but also when we think about the global world more broadly.
Thanks so much, Rashaan. That's very powerful. And I want to come back to much of what you've discussed about the role of social media companies in particular. But next, I want to turn to Heidi. You've done an enormous amount of original research around the scope of the threat. And I wondered if you might be able to give us a sense of the different types of groups and individuals that you've seen as main actors in the white supremacist movement and your perspective on what is driving the growth of this movement.
Well, first, I want to thank Brookings and thank Dan for inviting me here and congratulate him on his book. Yes, I'm happy to talk about what is driving this movement. First of all, I should say it's a complex movement. There are some fundamental ideas that drive most white supremacists. One of the most motivating is the idea that they are being literally replaced. This is the great replacement conspiracy theory, by black and brown people in what they consider their own home countries. And that idea has motivated a lot of the terrorist incidents that Dan mentioned at the beginning, like Christchurch, New Zealand mosque shooting, Pittsburgh synagogue shooting here, and many others. But that said, it's a relatively diverse movement. You have, for example, accelerationist neo-Nazis, groups like the Adam Waffen Division and the Base, that are transnational sprawling movements that want to actually accelerate system collapse. That's where the term comes from. You also have anti-immigrant movements, misogynistic movements that have been involved in violence, your regular old white supremacists. And so it's a relatively diverse scene, but all very much tied up to violence. But I would argue that the thing that is really driving all of this is the fear of demographic change on the part of these groups. You know, as Rashaan just said, this is deeply rooted in our history, this idea, American history, European history, this idea that white people should rule, that white supremacy should be the way things are. And all of these groups, because of this demographic change, feel that this is slipping away. And that's what they're responding to. The Great Replacement is just a conspiracy idea to explain what is natural demographic change. And actually, the number of these organizations started to grow about at the time that the census first talked about the white population becoming a minority in, say, 2042. That was in the 2000 census. And when I was working at the Southern Poverty Law Center, we immediately started to see huge jumps in the number of hate groups in the U.S. Of course, Obama's election accelerated that process, and then Trump became a feedback loop, basically empowering these people. But the thing behind it all is demographic change, and that's why often immigrants are considered evil by these movements.
Thanks so much, Heidi. I wonder if you could all, perhaps starting with Dan, speak a little bit about the different strategies that white supremacist groups use to try to expand their base. And to, as Rashaan put it, normalize white supremacy and to gain traction among the wider population.
So when we talk about strategy, I think one thing I want to say as a caveat is white supremacists have a lot of strategies. Many of them are bad strategies. So they do have ideas. They're constantly debated on the internet and so on about the best way to go forward. But before I kind of plunge in, I want to point out that a lot of these are unrealistic. So some of them simply believe that the United States is already on the brink of collapse, and that if you do a few attacks, it's going to cause chaos and social problems, and that people will flock to their banner. Dr. Bayrich mentioned accelerationism, and this idea kind of takes us one step further, where you're really trying to exacerbate social tension. And the belief is we're already heading in this direction, and violent white supremacists can act as change agents and push us even further. Another approach is what they would call kind of awakening the masses. And sometimes they use language from movies like The Matrix to talk about taking the appropriate pill and seeing what's really in front of you, which in their eyes is this kind of, you know, evil racial plot that, whether organized by Jews or others, to try to undermine white hegemony. And there are the ideas that violence will open the eyes of the uncommitted and push people to their side. Where things get of more concern to me in terms of potential for success is the interaction between more mainstream political voices and more violent figures. And here you're rarely going to see someone who is hoping for, you know, national or even state level political office call for violence. But on the other hand, we see a lot of demonization that at times uses coded language and even more troubling in recent years, uncoded, blatant language, whether against immigrants or the Black community, particularly vehemence against Muslims. And that whips up the extremists, that incites violence, it legitimates what they're doing. And at the same time, the extremist violence puts these people in the news. But strategically, one thing I would emphasize is that there isn't huge support for the violent side of this movement. Often when they use violence, it backfires. Many people who are listening will recall the Unite the Right demonstration in Charlottesville in 2017, where a counter-protester, Heather Heyer, died during this. And that was, in my view, a disaster for this broader movement. It made them seem, rather than wholesome Americans who were fighting for traditional society, it made them seem like, frankly, the extremists they were. And it alienated many people. It led many more mainstream political figures to openly reject them. So there is some hope that their attempts for influence are going to backfire on them.
I'd love to hear Rashawn's views on specifically how January 6th has played into this movement.
Yeah, I mean, January 6th, it continues to be big. I mean, I'm not sure we can necessarily say it was big. I mean, obviously, we know it's making its way to the Supreme Court, particularly when we think about what's happening with Clarence Thomas and his wife and text messages. And so accordingly, based on January 6th, part of what we realized is the way that the various branches of government become complicit in what's happening. We saw the executive branch playing a role in this, the legislative branch, and again, now the judicial branch based on who people are in relationships with, in terms of pushing for various ways to overturn the government, and then corresponding, being in some sort of complicit nature with the domestic terrorists who storm the Capitol. Again, I think it speaks to a lack of government direction. And of course, when we talk about law enforcement, this is one of the ways we see a big juxtaposition. And one of the ways that we haven't seen, I think, in modern history, at least in the way that we think about it, the blue wall of silence became fractured in a way that people seem to support. And what I mean by that is we have video evidence of police officers being attacked. Of course, some of them and others ended up dying ultimately. And so we can think about the ramifications of that, of all these police officers being attacked by a group of people who supposedly want to uphold America, but it became clear that they only wanted to uphold it for themselves. What's also important to note there is that the same way some police officers were being attacked, it's the same way that some of them were being complicit, literally in a very direct way. I mean, from kiki and ha-haing with them to taking pictures with them, doing all of this sort of thing. And we saw the imagery. We saw an Auschwitz camp shirt. We saw a noose. We saw all of the imagery, the symbolism that white supremacists play up. And it became, I think, for them, an opportunity for them to try to reclaim America for what they think, what they believe is intended to be, which is for individuals who look like them and their rightful heirs. So January 6th became something where it was on full display, not just for people in the United States, but around the world to see. And I think for those of us who study these particular issues, what we saw is how much this has become such a huge problem. But as we are seeing with the January 6th hearings, it's going to be interesting to see how this moves forward. Because again, there are people at multiple levels who are complicit in this particular process. And it speaks to, as I was saying earlier, the trickle down form of white supremacy and the normalization of these particular processes.
Heidi, in your work and in the work of all of our panelists here today, you've highlighted, as Rashaan said, that law enforcement and the military as well have often been both a target of domestic terrorism by white supremacists, but also a target of recruitment. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about the sort of challenge around law enforcement, around both recruitment and the potential violence.
Sure. Well, I mean, the FBI actually warned in 2006 about white supremacist recruitment of law enforcement. This has been a longstanding issue that has largely been ignored. And what we saw on January 6th, where there were active duty police officers among the mob storming the Capitol, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder with white supremacists and other extremists, highlighted this problem. And in the last year or so, we've had a number of leaks of membership lists of extremist groups that have shown dozens and dozens of law enforcement officers, for example, being involved in the anti-government Oath Keepers group. This, the leader's been indicted for seditious conspiracy related to January 6th. A bunch of members have been indicted. And I think that this is a problem that we have ignored for far too long and minimized as well. You know, the thinking usually is this is a teeny tiny problem. It's not really something we have to worry about. But I think the disclosures lately have shown that this is a lot bigger problem than we think. There are also a couple hundred at least elected sheriffs across this country who are involved in anti-government activism, who believe things like the sheriff is the highest law enforcement official in the country, and that they have the ability to repel any kind of federal activities in their counties. And, you know, it's hard to, you know, I can't stress enough how bad this situation is. This is an insider threat. If a law enforcement official is a member of an extremist group, they threaten investigations, they threaten communities, most importantly, they destroy morale. And we don't really have a solution for this. Biden's plan to counter domestic terrorism mentions this problem as well as the problem with extremists in the military. But there are 18,000 law enforcement agencies across this country, and I teach a course on this exact issue for the University of Southern California. And there really aren't policies in place to deal with it anywhere. And so this is really important, just like the issue of military radicalization. And I can just tell you, extremist groups will do everything they can to recruit police officers and military for their tactics, for their access to intelligence, for the standing they give them. And that was all on display on January 6th, because some of the tactics used by the extremist groups that invaded the Capitol would not have been possible without those skills.
Suzanne, if you don't mind, I'm going to jump in on the point that both Heidi and Rashaan have raised, because I want to talk about the legacy of January 6th, which to me had big implications for this movement. If you look at kind of high-profile acts of violence, and as everyone knows, you can define terrorism in different ways, but if you consider these, we've actually had many months, well over a year, where we haven't seen white supremacist attacks in the United States. And part of it, I think, is the legacy of January 6th. There was a massive crackdown on anything touching this broader movement that was tied to January 6th. So you saw not only lots of people arrested, but you saw lots of people in this community start to get scared of the government. And this, to me, is a big shift. A lot of this movement, in a very painful way, has operated in plain sight for many years. From their point of view, they were heroes defending their community. They were acting openly, talking openly, and they didn't have to worry too much about federal pressure, about the FBI, unless they were doing the most violent action. And that stands in contrast to jihadist groups and others that were always looking over their shoulder, fearing that the government was going to go after them. But once the government put a lot of resources into this, which the Biden administration was doing as part of the January 6th investigation, you start to see a lot of cracks in this movement. And so it's led people to be very concerned that anything they say is going to be monitored. It's made people more cautious in their actions. And it's also led people to turn on each other to avoid jail time or other criminal issues. So it's important to recognize that government can play a tremendous role if it is willing to resource this problem.
I'd love to hear all of you speak a little bit about the role of social media. Obviously, this has already been referenced in our conversation so far, the ways that it enables organizational development among white supremacist groups, recruitment, but also the role that algorithms have to play in essentially normalizing white supremacy. And what is it that, you know, has happened since the advent of social media? Obviously, a tool that we're using this morning to discuss the problem. How has that impacted the movement? And what are the tools that both companies, the private sector, and the government can use to try to undercut some of the use of social media as a tool of recruitment? Please, anyone jump in on this, because I know you've all written quite a bit about it.
Well, I'm happy to take the first shot here. Look, social media has been so important to the growth of hate movements, white supremacy. It's almost hard to underestimate it. You know, when I started working at the Southern Poverty Law Center in 1999, if you wanted to get information about a Klan group or some other white supremacist, you had to get on a mailing list. There was no, you know, you couldn't look in the phone book for information. You needed to be on a fax list. The ability to organize, hold events, everything was very difficult for these folks at the time. But with the advent of social media, that changed radically. And also, I think what you have to keep in mind is that from the time that Facebook and Twitter were founded in the 2000s, there were essentially no content moderation rules. In fact, that situation lasted until Charlottesville in 2017. The attitude, and I spent a lot of time lobbying tech companies to get hate off their platforms. The attitude was good speech will crowd out bad speech. We need to, although free speech doesn't apply to a private company, we need to uphold those ideas. It was sort of a libertarian ethos. And white supremacists are early adopters. They understand that they have to use these tools to get around what they call, you know, the mainstream media, these kinds of things, to build their movements. And they did it, and they did it successfully. And they recruit, we really don't know how much recruitment happened. So just as these demographic forces were making people with racial issues have anxiety about change, there was this new tool that was essentially unregulated that came about that allowed them to organize and harness that. So you can't look at the metastasizing problem of right-wing extremist groups in this country without understanding the role of social media and the fact that this space was just left to be the Wild West, essentially, for about, you know, 15 years.
So let me add to what Heidi was saying. In fact, I want to add something that Heidi told me in research for my book, which was the social media companies have these handy ways of making things easier for the user. So when you're doing, say, a Google search, if you're looking at a restaurant, it might autocomplete the restaurant or say restaurant near me or something like that, and it makes my life easier. But it was also doing that in a white supremacist way. So, you know, many years ago, if you were searching for Jews, you would get autocomplete suggestions like plots to take over the world. And as Heidi said, they were pretty blasé about this. It was, you know, well, you know, it's a free market of ideas and what can you do? And there have been a lot of changes to try to take out the most egregious sorts of things like that. They've tried to reduce the presence of overt white supremacist organizations on many of the big platforms. Now, they're still there in lots of ways. They show up in lots of ways. And there is a big problem when we think about radicalization. And, you know, some of these things people have talked about, like echo chambers, may be present. But a big one is people who, as Rashawn was saying earlier, people who are kind of engaged in some sort of trickle-down racism, where maybe you're not violent, but you're kind of laughing and listening to racist jokes. That sort of person tends to become vulnerable on this because you listen to, you get some racist jokes about Black people, and then maybe you get some about Hispanic people, and then you get a conspiracy theory about Jews, and then you learn Muslims coming as refugees are secret terrorists, and you start to surround yourself with a set of hateful ideas. And that pushes you in a very, very dangerous direction. And social media enables that relatively quickly. In the past, that was a more gradual process just because the amount of propaganda that could be consumed had to be slower for the vast majority of people. What I would add, though, about social media are two things. One is I do believe the companies are taking this much more seriously. Now, if you followed some of the revelations about Facebook and others, you know, there are still huge problems. You know, one of which I'd say is they emphasize English language content, and a lot of white supremacist stuff is in English. But there are other countries that have this problem. We see it in Germany, we see it in Poland, we see it in Sweden, and there's much less emphasis on non-English language content. Also, many of them don't resource this properly. It's much easier for them politically and bureaucratically to link on to things linked to foreign terrorist organizations than it is to domestic groups. The squishy movement nature of a lot of this, as opposed to organized groups, makes it harder for them to pinpoint where all this begins and ends. So all these are very difficult problems for these organizations. But one thing I would emphasize is that social media can also be a benefit for counterterrorism, that people are often revealing a remarkable amount of information about their beliefs, about their actions, about violence they intend to use on social media, thinking that it's only they and their 10 people who are listening when one of those people is reporting to the FBI. Social media, it also enables both researchers and especially government law enforcement to identify people in a network. So part of what social media does so well is connect people, but that also makes it easier for counterterrorism officials to identify not just one dangerous individual, but all the people that he or she is connected to.
Yeah. Rashawn, do you see opportunities for the social media companies to be more aggressive in preventing the spread of these ideologies in these organizations?
I think so. I mean, particularly when it comes to content moderation, which is what we're hearing about. With the group of scholars with some funding from the CDC and APHA, we did a report on bystander intervention on social media. And we compared Twitter to Reddit. And we chose those because they're different types of platforms, but also because we were exploring the way that people respond to racism and racial discourses. And we found that there were quite differences between Twitter and Reddit, primarily dealing with content moderation. As people know, as we just heard, and of course, we are on Twitter having this conversation, and I'll get to Twitter Spaces in a second. But people have perceived in some ways Twitter to be the wild, wild west of social media for a lot of people. People like that. I mean, personally, I enjoy some of the ways that Twitter allows people to say certain things. And of course, we could think about how those violations end up popping up in the way that we're having this conversation. How does it go from kind of free speech to all of a sudden it becoming hate speech that infuses what's going on? I mean, we do have to remember that in places where Trump campaigned at in 2016, hate crimes increased over 200%. So we know that people's words matter. I mean, all the way up from his 2016 election run to what happened on January 6th. But the content moderation is key because if we go to Reddit, as people know on Reddit, you typically join a group. If it's kind of a closed group, you have to be admitted. There are individuals who are serving as guides and actual moderators. There are oftentimes rules for engagement. And it doesn't mean that things don't get heated. And it doesn't mean that hate language doesn't pop up. And we found that in our analysis. But we also found that the content moderation was much more likely to occur on Reddit than Twitter. Now, accordingly, spaces like Twitter have responded with, say, Twitter Spaces, with other ways to kind of create a group communal environment. That's really important because these echo chambers that Dan was referring to, some of my previous work was looking at the way that the Black Lives movement the way that the Black Lives Matter movement came to be on social media. And of course, looking at this with Twitter. And we were doing this analysis of the most used hashtags. And of course, people think Black Lives Matter, this is going to be very popular. But there was another one that stood out that pretty much none of us had heard before. And it was called TCOT, Top Conservatives on Twitter. And when we did our investigation, we found that TCOT was a group of people that were far extreme, that viewed themselves as taking credit for for creating and kind of firmly cementing the Tea Party within the Republican Party in the way we view it today, where you have moderate Republicans and right-wing extremists becoming troublesome bedfellows. And then they also took credit for revitalizing the alt-right, quote unquote, under this new term, and firmly cementing it within the American ethos and other parts around the world. What's fascinating is that we analyzed 32 million tweets. And less than 0.1% of all of those 32 million tweets, 0.1%, less than that, use the hashtags TCOT and Black Lives Matter together, suggesting that these groups that supposedly are opposed to one another are not having conversations with each other at all. And these echo chambers, the way that our algorithms work, allows for that trickle-down white supremacy to happen, where the people who are comfortable with the jokes, where the people who are comfortable with saying, well, I think maybe we do need to think about racial segregation and housing, all of a sudden that leads to this infiltration and pulling them farther to the right. And then conversely, you have another group of people that are being pulled to the left. So one of the big things that we highlighted is that content moderation is key. We also found that that pro-social education and evidence was highly effective in over 70% of the analysis that we had on Reddit and Twitter. That is what people were doing. It didn't mean you had to engage in insults and mocking, which was much more likely to occur on Twitter than Reddit because of the content moderation. But the education and evidence was very, very key. And bottom line is this: companies like Twitter and Facebook and, well, Meta, with Facebook and Instagram, they are now understanding the role that they play even without government intervention. And accordingly, we need not just the Department of Justice, as we heard, to step in, but we need what's happening with the legislative branch in Congress to formulate policies that are going to be able to hold people accountable for these type of actions, because it is impacting all of us.
Heidi, turning quickly back to you on this, is there more that social media companies can do? You've written and testified quite a bit on some specific steps that you'd recommend.
Yeah, I mean, the situation, I think, as Dan rightly said, is a lot better today than it was, say, 5 years ago. But, and the policies that most of these companies have now, the mainstream companies, obviously there are places like Telegram that are unmoderated, aren't bad. I mean, they're just not. The issue is all about enforcement. And the issue is also about content in languages other than English. It's about the ability to understand cultural context. And there are some loopholes in the policies that, from my perspective, very much need to be changed. For example, on Facebook, there are loopholes. There's a whitelist for people who are influencers and also political figures, which means that if I'm Narendra Modi and I'm the Prime Minister of India, I can say hateful things that a regular person can't say, which obviously has a huge impact. In the case of Facebook/Meta, their own oversight board has told them that this has to stop. You know, so the policies are better. The enforcement isn't good. It's worse the further you get away from the United States. Essentially, you get to languages like, for example, Swahili, and you find things to be completely unmoderated, whether we're talking about social media, or we're talking about things like Wikipedia, or we're talking about the way search mechanisms work. So there's a ton of work to still be done. And the place where government regulations are probably going to come to bear first is going to be in the European Union and in places like the UK, where they're taking these issues much more seriously. Germany has had a stringent law on the books related to hate online for a few years now. So there will be government regulation. But the fact of the matter is the companies need to invest a lot of their billions into cleaning these spaces up. Otherwise, we will continue to see terrorist attacks, hate crimes, recruitment of these people. And we shouldn't forget that a lot of what happened on January 6th had to do with what people were doing on Facebook. It took until very late in the fall of 2020 for Facebook to purge, for example, the Proud Boys. It's just another example of where you might have policies, but you're not applying them. And if you don't apply them, yeah, it doesn't really matter.
Dan, I want to pick up on a really important dimension of your book, and it's related to some of what Heidi was just discussing, which is the extent to which this really is a transnational issue. And of course, your book address, you know, provides a really useful history of episodes of violence from New Zealand to Norway to South Carolina. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, the feedback loop between the groups that are organized domestically, their connections to transnational groups. And then I'd really welcome a discussion around how the United States and other governments are managing this threat or seeking and organizing to confront this threat, and how that compares to the way that they have handled and managed the threat from jihadist groups.
So on the transnational front, there's good news and bad news. So the good news is we're not seeing what we would call operational coordination around the world. So we're not seeing the kind of command and direction of people in the United States telling, you know, the shooter in New Zealand what to do, or people in Europe that are, you know, training large numbers of people and sending them around the world to fight. So the sort of problems we saw with groups like the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, we're not seeing. However, we are seeing an increasingly networked set of individuals and a broader movement that truly is global. And so if you look at the New Zealand shooter, when he does his attack, he is making references to a series of events in the United States and politics in this country. He is referencing European history. And of course, he is from Australia and acting in New Zealand. And we are seeing this sort of connection in terms of discourse, where immigrant waves in one part of the world will prompt anger and outrage in places thousands of miles away. The issues are seen as a broader threat to white people, rather than in the past, where it was much more focused on my community, my particular area. In addition, we're seeing more global models of action. So I mentioned Anders Breivik at the beginning of this session, and you know, his model of kind of going in guns blazing and having posting a manifesto to the internet. We saw Brenton Tarrant do that in New Zealand in 2019, only he, using the latest technology, live streams it on Facebook. We see what Tarrant was doing shows up in the United States, where people are also trying to use their manifestos to put things online as they're going in guns blazing. And so you start to have modes of action that spread around the world as well. Now, if you think about this from a counterterrorism point of view, this can create an opportunity, because it means that law enforcement and intelligence in one country can discover something and share it with another and reveal a vulnerability. This was done very effectively after 9/11 in the jihadist space, where one of the most effective, if not the most effective, forms of counterterrorism was global intelligence sharing, where individuals who traveled or communicated would be detected, and that would reveal entire networks. For the white supremacist world, this is much harder for the United States, given especially First Amendment protections, where there are a lot of what the violent fringe of this movement is doing in the United States. American law enforcement has to be very careful that they're focused on violent activity rather than shutting down more broader radicalism. And there's no question in my mind, this is a double standard, that there are actions taken against people who are linked to jihadist groups, and you have people doing the same sort of things for a different ideology, getting a different response. But it's because the United States is, you know, legally able to list terrorist groups who are considered foreign, and that gives law enforcement a lot of power, and there isn't a domestic equivalent to this. Now, having said that, there's a lot of state and local power to go after these individuals. And so there is certainly, you know, plenty of power of the government in general. But in terms of international coordination, we're not, we don't have as much power from a government point of view. But beyond that, they're not used to thinking in those terms. This is still a space dominated by more domestic agencies. And although they recognize there are international connections, this is not integrated into the national security foreign policy bureaucracies in the same way that anti-jihadist counterterrorism was.
That's a particularly worrisome point to note from someone who served on the 9/11 Commission and is obviously familiar with some of the intelligence failures that went into that tragedy. I wanted to bring Heidi back into the conversation. You've written and testified about some of the tools that law enforcement can use and also some of the complications of using designations like the Foreign Terrorist Organization designation to target some of these groups, and hoped you might be able to talk a little bit from your perspective on these issues.
Yeah, I mean, broadly, I agree with the way that Dan was speaking about this. You know, there had been a lot of discussion about whether or not to introduce some sort of domestic terrorism statute, and the Biden administration basically declined in its strategy document from June 2021. At my organization, we also had concerns about going down this route because the United States has an unfortunate history of using increased law enforcement abilities against sort of the wrong folks. And what I'm thinking of is obviously the surveilling of people like Martin Luther King in the 1960s, but also the way the Muslim community in this United States in the post 9/11 era had to deal with quite a bit of violations of its civil liberties, surveillance, and so on. And I just don't think that that's a route for us to go down. I'm a little bit more open to the idea of designating white supremacist groups that have headquarters outside of the United States under some sort of terrorist label. There already is one, the Russian Imperial Movement, which is headed out of St. Petersburg, but there are others that could fall into this boat. For example, the base's leader lives also in Russia, that where you could use more tools to combat them outside of the United States. But I do believe at the end of the day, there has to be a lot more information sharing, better intelligence gathering. You know, I see that, you know, the DHS actually had a lot of information leading up to January 6th. That something bad might happen that day and just didn't share it. You know, these are the kinds of things that are simple to fix as well as investing resources. I'll also say there was a recent interview with some folks at the Department of State who are involved in designating terrorist groups, especially designated organizations. And they told a podcast, Verified, that they just didn't have the resources to look at other organizations. Those kinds of things need to be changed. There's just no reason to not have those kinds of things in place.
One of the points that Dan's book makes is the kind of importance of a political consensus in opposition to white supremacy as vital for ensuring that government works effectively, that social media and other types of companies work effectively against the threat of these groups and the broader threat of trickle-down normalization of racism and white supremacy. Obviously, the United States is going through a very intense period of polarization. I just would love to hear Rashaan and others, all of you on the panel, talk a little bit about whether you think trends are moving in a more positive direction in terms of a greater political consensus, a more robust willingness across the partisan lines to confront these trends, or whether we are in fact still very much in a period of opportunistic exploitation of that partisanship and polarization by white supremacist groups.
I think things right now are highly polarized. And even though there's some movement to focus on, I want to put it in perspective on where I'm coming from. At the beginning of the pandemic, I did an analysis with Rebecca Shankman. She was an intern at Brookings. She's now getting her PhD in sociology at Ohio State. And we were looking at the rise in gun purchases. We were interested in how COVID was contributing to kind of fear and people being scared and feeling as the only thing they could do is purchase guns. And as we did this analysis, looking at gun purchases, ammos, and the like, in short, what we actually found was that gun purchases were increasing the most in politically polarized states, states that people would consider to be purple, these purple states where Republicans and Democrats are battling one another. And then, of course, on the heels of what was happening with our analysis, we had these anti-lockdown protests, which there was very little accountability from Michigan to North Carolina when it came to these particular incidents. And then, of course, we fast forward and we have January 6th. And for us, we saw a direct link there. And part of bringing up guns is what? Well, if you look in some places, and again, I'll talk about in a second the shift and the states and places where we might see more progress that people might want to see. But in a lot of places, things are going in the exact opposite direction. There are states that are now, including my great state of Tennessee, that are simply allowing people to own a gun and have a gun without it being registered. I mean, it is the wild, wild west. And for certain people, they perceive that that form of legislation is coinciding with this trickle-down white supremacist rhetoric and behavior that is going to afford some people the ability to continue to take the law into their own hands and for other people to be penalized for it. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, we have other states that are aiming to strengthen their hate crime laws. I think the state of Maryland is probably one of the best examples with the Lieutenant Collins hate crime law. Lieutenant Collins, roughly 5 years ago, was murdered on the campus of the University of Maryland by a white student. Lieutenant Collins was an Army lieutenant, a student at Bowie State University, still in the same county, Prince George's County. And his murderer, Sean Urbanski, did not have hate crime charges brought against him because the judge ruled that the hate crime law as it stood was not strong enough. And people worked to get that law strengthened, where now it states that if anyone engages in a behavior where a protected clause, race, gender, sexual orientation, religion, and the like contributes to that behavior, then it can be considered a hate crime. And I think that if the federal government moves in that direction, and there are others, I'm curious what people on the panel think about this as well, is there are others who have argued that, sure, we need stronger hate crime laws. Clearly that hasn't happened. I mean, we just passed the Emmett Till anti-lynching legislation, as my grandfather would say, a day late and a dollar short when it comes to that, as it's been tried hundreds of times to get passed. But people have said that when we look at this particular process, that what we need is for stronger hate crime laws and to potentially treat hate crime groups as gangs, which will then allow law enforcement to do a lot more investigation. As you all know, I do a lot of work with law enforcement, and they tell me, they say, look, we want to pursue these groups. We just literally not only don't have the capacity, we also don't have the jurisdiction to actually go after them in the way that we would like to. We don't have the resources to do it, and the laws don't allow us to go that route. So I think there are definitely things to think about in a positive direction. But right now, things are highly polarized and people are worried where we're headed.
Dan, any thoughts on the political context? I thought that was a really important section of your book.
Sure. So this is something that's really troubling to talk about. There should be a bright, clear, and pretty obvious line between legitimate political discussion on issues that are uncomfortable and violence. And so there are questions about the proper level of immigration in the United States. And to me, that's a perfectly reasonable discussion to have. There are economic issues, there are social issues. That's society should have that discussion. You can have that discussion and take very different viewpoints and still make clear that any violence against a part of our community is utterly abhorrent and we completely reject it. And if you go back in recent decades, we saw politicians on the conservative end of the spectrum strongly rejecting violence, moving away from the kind of, you know, many of the horrific actions of political leaders in the American past to make it clear that, you know, they stand for certain policies, but reject the violent fringe and will try to direct the power of the U.S. government, but also the moral censure of American society against this. And this has huge power because it means people on the fringe have a much harder time recruiting, have a much harder time being able to get their ideas into the mainstream. But what we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years is that line eroding. And we see political candidates running for office, especially at the local level, who are openly embracing a range of hateful ideas, engaging with people on the far fringes. And this is most troubling to me because I don't see a way to turn back the clock, at least in the near term, for something that I think should be relatively obvious. Again, I just don't feel that this is a particularly hard ask, yet it seems somewhat impossible to say that people should be openly and consistently rejecting the violent fringe on the white supremacist and extreme right.
We are coming close to the end of our hour, and I know all of our panelists are awfully busy and have other obligations in just a few moments, but for our last kind of wrap-up question, I wanted to ask each of the experts here today to give us just their perspective on what might be the top one or two steps that they would recommend either at the federal, state, or local level, or for companies and organizations to take that could contribute to stemming the tide of white supremacist violence. And I'd like to start with Dr. Bayrich, sort of in reverse order. We'll go to Dr. Bayrich, Dr. Ray, and then over to Dr. Vyman, my colleague, Dan.
Sure, thank you. Well, on the social media front, this is an issue about enforcement. Dan's comments just now made me think too, that if I could do something in the world, I would wish that prominent members of the Republican Party would stand up against the extremism that is very much infecting their ranks and reject people who are running for office on that platform who have, you know, connections to things like QAnon, white supremacy. We have seen lately people in Congress attending white nationalist events. This erosion, which is such a huge change from the GOP from just a few, just from the George Bush era, is really, really troubling. And I don't see a way out on it as the party seems to continually radicalize and move further to the right. And that would be very important. Principled conservatives rejecting hateful ideas and any association with them. So that's sort of my wish.
So I completely agree. I mean, I don't have much to add. I think that is the big thing. I mean, the other thing that I'll say is, of course, part of that would then come along with strengthening hate crime laws at the federal level, not being 100 years behind. I don't want to be setting up having this conversation. Well, I probably won't be around in 100 years. But in terms of the people who will, talking about it as if we've been having this conversation related to the Emmett Till anti-lynching bill. But Dan nailed it in his book. If we pivot and talk about social media platforms and companies, he stated that they don't want to ban white supremacists because they're worried about losing revenue and political support from conservatives. And it goes back to this point that Heidi just made. We need conservatives. We need Republicans who don't align with the white supremacist movement to come out and formally detach from them. And that is not happening. And that is helping to drive this trickle down white supremacy that is impacting all of us.
So rather than repeat my colleagues, let me simply say that there are two things we need for an effective police and law enforcement response. The first is the sort of thing I realize a researcher is going to say, but to me is vital, which is we actually need good data and statistics on the extent of the problem. In the United States, the laws are kind of a hodgepodge in terms of what must be reported and what isn't reported. The statistics available can often be very misleading about the extent of a problem. There are a lot of things that are simply not reported. And so we need to have some sense of the problem, and that requires much better reporting. The problem is even bigger in Europe and many other countries. There are countries in Central Europe that have huge problems, but often don't report basic statistics. So they're not aware of the extent of the violence and the extent of the day-to-day harassment of vulnerable communities. As you get better data, what you really need to do then is resource the problem. And again, this is a relatively simple recommendation, but what often happens on counterterrorism is we tend to oscillate between threats rather than recognizing that we're going to see ups and downs over the years, and you need to have consistent resourcing. We need to make sure that the law enforcement intelligence communities can gain a strong understanding of this world, that they can have plenty of people who are reporting on this, and that they can take consistent action. And what that means is we're going to have to do this across administrations. It can't simply be the Biden administration does X and then the next Trump administration repeals all this. This has to be something that's bipartisan, and we have to recognize that all Americans, and frankly, all right-thinking citizens around the world really want to stop this problem.
Well, thank you, Dan. That's a perfect note to end on. And I hope that all of the recommendations that you've all provided today are heeded and implemented quickly. I want to thank Dr. Rashaan Ray, Dr. Heidi Beirich from Brookings, University of Maryland, the Global Project on Hate and Extremism, respectively, and also Dr. Dan Byman, and encourage you all to really dig into the work of all of our scholars and experts here on this discussion, but especially Dan's new book, Spreading Hate, The Global Rise of White Supremacist Terrorism.